Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started with this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. We are in order. Members present today on Saturday, March 15th, 2008 are Senators Bundy, Davis, and myself, Senator Ellis. We're beginning the meeting just a few moments after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We have quite a bit of business before us today. First, we'll be taking up a proposed committee substitute regarding Senate Bill 297, Non-Union Public Employee Salary and Benefits, and Senate Bill 294 as well, the RCA positions and salaries. There's a proposal to deal with those two bills together. So we'll discuss that and consider action, and then we'll move back to the subject of identity theft, House Bill 65, and continue with the work there. And I'm hoping to get as much done as we possibly can today. And I understand Senator Bundy needs to go at 5 o'clock, and we do expect other committee member or members to be on their way. So we'll try and maintain the quorum and get as much done as possible. At this time, we now have Senate Bill 297 before us. There's a proposed committee substitute. I'm going to ask committee staff, Mr. Owen, to come forward and walk us through the proposed CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dana Owen. I'm staff to Senator Ellison to this committee. The committee substitute you have before you consolidates two bills, Senate Bill number 297, which is the number that the CS bears, has been consolidated with Senate Bill number 294, which was pertained only to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The provisions that were in that bill now are in the CS. I'll walk you through this section by section because it's a fairly long bill and there are some fairly significant changes.
Mr. Owen, before you proceed, just for the committee members, the thinking was that the governor's bill also contains sections relating to the RCA in terms of benefits.
Yes, that's correct.
Or in terms of salaries. And so we've consolidated all of those to sort of have a more of a overarching approach to pay and benefits for one vehicle to move forward.
Yes. Okay. In order to accomplish that, we've had to change the title. So you have a new title on the CS now. The drafters felt they needed to broaden the title a bit to be able to accommodate.
Which is fine because we're in the body of origin for the bill.
That's correct.
Okay.
Sections 1 through 4, there are no change. Those are the same as you find in the original bill. Just as an FYI, the reference to commissioners is to the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. In Section 5,
can you give page numbers as we go along?
Sure. Section 5 of the bill. Section 5 of the bill appears on page 2, line 15, and it places the executive director of the RCA, which is enacted in Section 12 of the bill, into the exempt service. Section 6 of the bill, also on page 2, line 17, corrects terminology that exists in RCA statutes. Currently, we refer to hearing officers in the statutes, and I'm told that it's more correctly hearing examiners, so we made that correction in this bill.
Okay. Mr. Dana, before you go forward, just note for the record that Senator Stevens has joined us. And Senator Stevens, we're on the proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 297. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Sections 7 through 10, which appear on lines 20, page 22, down through page 3, line 30, are from the original bill. These sections are crucial to the original bill. They are the new pay schedule and the three-year raises over FY 2008, 2009, and 2010. One of those sections also establishes a longevity pay system for employees who reach step F of the pay schedule. Section 11, which appears on page 4, line 14, sets all RCA commissioner salaries, including the chairs, at step F, range 30. Under the bill, the chair would no longer have administrative duties. We will further in the bill create an executive director's position, which will assume those those duties. As a result, all the commissioners receive the same pay, including the chair.
So that's reflective, Mr. Owen, of the recommendations of the RCA task force?
That's correct.
Okay.
Section 12, which is on line 20, also page 4, establishes the position of RCA executive director, clarifies that the commission hires the executive director and administrative law judges. That is to say, the administrative law judges report to the commission and not to the executive director. The section further sets out the responsibilities, the powers, and the limitations of the executive director position. Sections 13 through 14 on page 5, starting at line 4, going through line 18. These are conforming amendments that result from our creation of the executive director's position in the previous section. Sections 15 through 16 are not changed from the original bill. That begins on page 5, line 19, and continues through page 6, line 3. Section 17, Section 17, this was another amendment that was brought to us by the court system. Court employees not covered by a collective bargaining unit, including magistrates, but excluding judges and justices, are under the same Section 7 through 9 pay schedule and two-year increases as executive branch non-covered employees. In other words, it brings the judicial branch into the same structure that the executive branch was being brought into by the original bill. Additionally, the court may adopt the longevity pay increments of a formula of Section 10. But that's not mandatory. It's they can do it if they like. Sections 18 through 20, and Section 18 begins on line 22, page 6, runs through page 7, line 14.
So before you get into that, Mr. Owen, so with what's there on page 6, we would have addressed the two concerns of the court system, the look back on pay and the magistrate issue. Is that correct?
Yes, with one exception. We add judges to the retroactivity provisions later in the bill.
Oh, later
but
in
yes,
the bill.
That
okay.
will.
But the magistrate issue is
yes, the
is
magistrate
resolved.
Issue is resolved in those
okay.
sections.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Let's see. There were 18 through 20 were no change from the original bill. And then Section 21 is the new retroactivity clause. And that's the same as the original bill, except that we add justices and judges into the retroactivity provisions. Section 22 on page 7, line 23, makes a longevity formula for executive branch employees that's enacted in Section 10, contingent upon the administration formally offering the same benefit to all state employee bargaining units. In other words, it doesn't take effect until the same provision is offered to state employee bargaining units.
Okay.
Section 23 is immediate effective dates, and I believe that's the same. It's immediate effective date for the new pay schedule, and we had to modify. I think we brought judges into it as well. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly whether we had changed it from the original, but today the version you have in front of you has an immediate effective date for the new pay schedule, the sections of the act covering the exempt branch employees, judicial employees, judges and justices, university employees are part of the retroactivity provisions. Section 24 is the effective date for all the other sections, July 1st, 2008.
Okay, thanks for the run-through, Mr. Owen. Comments or questions from members of the committee? Senator Bundy.
I assume with these additions there will be a new fiscal note.
Senator Bundy, or Mr. Chairman, yes, I assume that we would get a new fiscal note.
Okay. Any other comments or questions?
You mean other than the poison pill?
Well, if that's the way you want to characterize it, that's obviously your choice. Thank you, Mr. Owen. Appreciate your running through the proposed committee substitute.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, I have some handouts also on this that have been provided by speakers that will come up.
Okay. Is there anyone who signed up to testify on this bill?
Yes, we have RCA members.
Okay. Okay, let's go to the teleconference. I have Rich Gazaway and Tony Price.
Yes, this is Commissioner Tony Price. I would offer some testimony if I could.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I consider this my time to provide the committee my best advice and the reasons why. I would encourage committee members to review the presentation by RCA staff to the HCRA Legislative RCA Task Force, which provides insight into the burdens faced by the RCA in fulfilling its statutory obligations within the recently imposed statutory timelines. These dedicated professionals care about the success of the RCA and its impact on the public. They believe you understand the impact we have on every citizen of this state, whether they turn on a light, heat their house or business with gas, run water from a faucet, flush a toilet, or use the phone, or use public services funded by oil transported on taps. The information regarding responsibilities, volumes of cases, technical knowledge, expertise, and statutory time deadlines of the RCA were previously unknown by the committee. Over 1,700 orders were issued by this agency in calendar year 2007 and required the review of volumes of filings and testimony. Unknown, too, was the critical lack of people in technical advisory positions and the fact we can't hire people at state pay levels with knowledge and experience. We have to grow them from within. An expensive training process requiring money and 2 years time. In 2 years, they become minimally productive. Such commissioners can begin to rely on their advice. They are, however, still not experts. So what is the benefit of addressing the pay and staffing problems of the RCA separately from those existing statewide? Can't this wait for a fix that fixes all these statewide pay problems all at once down the road at an undefined future date? Some view this as a perfect solution. My advice is it's impossible to achieve. The problem is too big. It's a Mount McKinley-sized personnel issue. If you want to climb Mount McKinley, you do it one step at a time, not in one giant step. RCA commissioner pay is one step on the state's journey. The next step is for the unions and administration to begin immediately to work together to remedy the compensation and related attraction and retention of RCA advisory staff during the next fiscal year. I do not desire to be a commissioner at a broken RCA, unable to retain and hire staff, perform its duties, and meet its statutory deadlines. The administration, Senate, and House should feel the same way. An ineffective RCA will lead to rates too high. Single parents, elderly on fixed income, and others living at the lower margins will be economically damaged the most. They have few resources to spare. People such as myself with resources will suffer the least. We all will grumble and write letters regarding the poor performance of the RCA, and this time we'll be right. In summary, if regulated utility and pipeline rates are just 10% too high, monopoly utilities and pipelines would collect an additional $95 million per year. There are winners and losers if the RCA is broken. Monopolies are winners, and ratepayers are losers. I want to avoid this, and I need your help. I support Senate Bill 294 because I believe compensating commissioners at range 30 gives you a chance to attract and retain highly qualified and experienced candidates for commissioner. In addition, the creation of an executive director creates continuity of management and administrative efficiency. I would also encourage the Alaska Legislature to perform the necessary studies to recognize RCA professional advisory staff as rare nationally and in Alaska and compensate appropriately. Said compensation needs to be implemented at the completion of the study, but not later than the beginning of fiscal year 2009. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Price, thank you very much. Mr. Gazaway, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, no, I didn't have any comment. I was available to answer questions if anywhere presented.
Okay, we appreciate that. We also have a Kathleen Strasbaugh available to answer questions. But let's move on to Mr. Bruce Ludwig. Testimony on the proposed committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Bruce Ludwig, and I'm the business manager of the Alaska Public Employees Association, AFT. We represent two state bargaining units, the state supervisors and the confidential employees, roughly 2,300 employees. We just completed negotiations and got 5.5 and 3.3, which is almost 12% compounded over the 3 years of the contract. But that does little to help the recruitment and retention problem that's facing the state. We have a number of positions that go unfilled every year because we can't find people that'll accept the salaries. Either accept the salaries or accept our high cost of living up here. Exacerbating that is the fact that about 45% of the employees are going to be eligible to retire within 5 years. Commissioner Kreitzer has made some changes to the personnel system in lowering the qualifications. And she says it's not dumbing it down, but it's giving people an opportunity that might not otherwise have the opportunity to apply for a job. And you train them and mentor them and basically grow your own employees. To be able to do that, you need experienced people to mentor them. You need to pass on the knowledge that the more experienced people have right now. The bill, as originally proposed, would only apply to 8% of the entire state workforce. The amendment that's in Section 20 makes it apply to 92%. And I passed out a spreadsheet that shows the different categories of employees, the units of them. And on the far right, the two groups, the partially exempt and the excluded, only represent 8% of the entire workforce. Classified employees in the rest of the workforce are 85% more, so it would be 93% that the amendment would cover that.
So, Mr. Ludwig, both of these papers are from you and your organization?
Yes.
Okay.
I should have put her name on them. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The other exhibit there shows the state service each of the bargaining units have. And you notice that other than the excluded, which has four employees, I think two of them have 30 years in, that's the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. The supervisors are by far the most senior, which it stands to reason. You know, they'd get promoted and stick around longer. And we need some kind of an incentive to get them to stay. And right now, the system we have tops out at step N. After you reach step N, there's no economic incentive other than getting cost of living increases, and those haven't been that forthcoming in the past. So this is a good incentive to get people to stay around. Another big benefit of this is there's been much ado made of the unfunded liability of the PERS system. And a big part of that is the cost of health benefits for retirees. When somebody retires, especially a Tier 1 employee, the state begins paying retirement right out the first month. And it's not cheap. It's, I don't know, $800 a head. So every month you keep somebody on the payroll in active status, you're not paying the retiree health insurance or the benefit. So while later on their benefit would be bigger because they stayed around longer, you're saving the money on the PERS system for the health insurance for the time. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Ludwig, thanks for your presentation today. Are there comments or questions at this time? If not, thank you for being with us. Next person to present is Mr. Kevin Brooks. Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks. Good afternoon. If you could just state your title and go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. I want to thank you for your efforts on hearing the bill and making amendments. I'd like to first start out with talking about the amendments related to the RCA, mm-hmm. because we had included portions, you know, the commissioners in the original bill that was submitted. We certainly are not opposed to inclusion of the other components that were brought in from the other bill. I did want to point out, though, with regard to the setting of the pay, our approach was to place the RCA commissioners at a range 27 without reference to steps. And the philosophy behind that, and in fact with some of the other positions we identified, was the steps become a limiting factor over time. And so in the past, we've had commissioners set at a 28F, or we've had the limited entry commissioner set at a 26C, and currently the RCA commissioners are a 26C. When we made them 27s without step reference, that really does provide flexibility. And I think if you're going to place it at a 30, that is at the high end of what we've established for department commissioners. Currently, by statute, department commissioners are placed anywhere from a range 28 to a range 30 without reference to steps. Mm-hmm. So what you've done here, and if it's your desire, I just wanted to make sure that you understood the comparability to other state agencies. These are the agency heads for each of the 14 state departments.
Sure.
And this would put them at the upper level. Mm-hmm. The other point I wanted to make was that on the 27 salary schedule, you could get to the equivalent of a 30F without the step designation. So again, we were approaching it from a flexibility perspective. Certainly your prerogative on how you want to place it in the ultimate CS there.
No, thanks for that comment. We, just on that point, this was the recommendation of the RCA task force. It was a House and Senate majority-minority task force that considered the issue and took the testimony and worked with the various parties involved. And so that's where that information came from. It wasn't my independent judgment, though I was a member and a supporter of the task force recommendations. This bill does have a further referral to the Finance Committee, and decisions will be made there as well about what can be afforded and what's a reasonable level. So this is just part of the discussion that will occur, obviously.
And I understand that. And I think the pay ultimately would be fairly comparable, whether one or the other. So the other section of the bill, probably not surprising that I'd like to talk about, is Section 20 mm-hmm. on the applicability. I guess the point I'd like to make there, Mr. Chairman, is encourage the committee's consideration is I think collective bargaining is best done at the bargaining table, not in legislation like this. There are a number of factors that led to the offer that was made and accepted by the SU bargaining unit, and also the package that was put together in the bill for non-covered employees. It's a very dynamic process. There were multiple offers on the table. Ultimately, one of them was chosen, offered, tentatively agreed to, and ratified. The language that you have here, I think it's important to point out that the SU bargaining unit a few years ago negotiated for service steps to replace longevity steps. And in doing so, they eliminated one of the items that we're trying to accomplish with the bill is the requirement that somebody have continuous service for 7 years in an F step before they can move. That's important as we hire people from outside or make promotions, because somebody could be placed at an F step and not be eligible for any kind of pay adjustment for 7 years. The SU bargaining unit has received that already several years ago, and so they don't have that same restriction on 7 years continuous service at F step. Another thing that we've done in previous negotiating sessions with the unit has been to add an end step. Again, these are things. When these things are on the table, there's a price associated with every one of them. And an end step was added for the SU bargaining unit that doesn't exist for other bargaining units. Similarly, the GGU unit has negotiated a G step that doesn't exist with other units. The LTC unit has a scheme that's set up where an individual after 6 months goes from an A to a B, they get about a 20% raise after 6 months. Then they don't see another one for 5 to 7 years. So LTC has taken an approach where they front-loaded their steps and somebody gets that upon 6 months. And so you're taking a disparate group of contracts here and trying to apply something, and what we make in an offer to one group isn't necessarily what we would do to another group. And every one of those things has a cost to them. I wanted to point out also that the step provisions that we've done in the bill for non-covered employees, you will not see that reflected in a fiscal note. It was the decision of the administration that state agencies would absorb those costs. And to offer them, when it was on the table with the SU unit, it was estimated that that was going to be an item that would cost $1.5 to $2 million a year. So again, different packages, different groups of people. The people covered in this bill, there's hundreds of people, as we've testified, thousands of people, literally. It does include 14 commissioners, about 25 deputy commissioners, about 80 directors, and hundreds of lawyers, countless accountants, clerks, and rank-and-file employees, not only in the executive branch, the court system, the legislative branch as well. So I would encourage you, Mr. Chairman, to not adopt Section 20, to leave collective bargaining at the table where it belongs, and let the administration work with these individual bargaining units and negotiate fair deals that are appropriate for them individually.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brooks, thank you very much for your time and testimony today. I personally look at this as a conversation starter. I'm under no illusions. I don't think any of us are that this this issue and all the issues in this bill wouldn't be revisited in the Finance Committee. So, but appreciate your comments today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Is there anyone further who would like to testify? I'll open up discussion then in the committee of the adoption of the committee substitute. It's the Wayne Cook / Wayne 31508 / E version that we've had here before us. We've taken the public testimony. Is there discussion among the committee? Or is there a motion to adopt the committee substitute at this time?
Are you waiting for a motion?
Yes. Senator Davis, do you would you like to make a motion to adopt the committee substitute? Okay, so moved.
CS for Senate Bill number 297, / E.
Right.
Is that the one we're on?
Yes. So you're moving the adoption of the CS?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much for the motion. Is there discussion of the motion? Senator Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, you've adopted the
no, this is where this is discussion of the motion to adopt the CS.
No, that's fine if you'd like to adopt it.
Okay. So no further discussion. Is there? There's no objection to adoption of the committee substitute. So the committee substitute is the item before us at this time.
Now, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Okay. We can have discussion now. I would entertain a motion to move the bill, and then did you want to speak to that?
Well, we've adopted the committee substitute. I'd just like to propose an amendment.
Okay, yes, this would be the proper time for markup of the committee substitute.
And as you might guess, I would propose that we, I think combining the two bills is basically wise. I agree with the administration that it's too handicapping of collective bargaining on the administrative side to have amendment or section 20. So I would propose that section 20 be deleted from the CS.
Okay. Senator Bundy, if you could just make reference to the page and the line, and you've made reference to the section, but just lay it out so it'll be on the record clearly.
Page 12, line 6 and 7. Beginning at line 6 and going through line 14.
Okay. So it's all of section 20 there on page 7. That's, in my estimation, clear and not necessary to be in writing. Is there discussion of the motion to remove that section from the bill? I'll object to the motion to remove that section from the bill. Is there any discussion? If not, I'll call for a roll call vote on the motion to remove Section 20 from the bill.
Senator Hoffman. Senator Bundy.
Yes.
Senator Davis.
No.
Senator Stevens.
Yes.
Chair Ellis.
No. Okay, so on a 2-2 tie, the motion does not pass. So the bill is back before us in the form that we adopted in the committee substitute. Is there further discussion? The bill does, as I noted, go on to the Finance Committee for further review. I appreciate what you said, Senator Bundy, about combining the two bills together. We're trying to expedite things and make them as clean and clear as possible. And again, I think all of these issues will be revisited in the Finance Committee for the fiscal impact, the affordability, all of those things. Okay, at this time, if there's no further discussion, I'll entertain a motion to forward the bill on to the next committee of referral.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 297/E with attached fiscal notes, which we don't have.
And individual, right.
And the individual recommendations.
Thank you, Senator Davis. The any amended fiscal notes will catch up with the bill as it moves through the process.
And I'll object.
So, Senator Bundy, thank you, has objected to the motion to move the bill. Is there discussion of the motion to forward the bill to the Finance Committee?
Well, speaking to my objection.
Please, go ahead.
And again, commendable effort. I just think that, as I characterized it earlier, Section 20 is a poison pill. And I've seen too many pieces of legislation that should have been fixed in committee end up on the floor. And I think this is a fix that should take place at this level, so I object.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bundy, for your comments. Is there further discussion of the motion to move the bill? Senator Stevens.
Chairman, I know we often move things on to the next committee of finance because that's where the big issues, fiscal issues, are determined. But I have a big problem with this issue of collective bargaining at any place other than the table. I've been a member of collective bargaining on both sides of the table, and it just concerns me that if you don't get what you want at the table, you go around it and find another way to do it. So I'm very concerned about this bill, and I want you to know that.
Okay.
With the inclusion of Section 20.
Okay. Well, we're on the record, so I'll just pose the question. I don't want to follow through on the motion to move the bill at this time if it's going to fail. I would just hold that until we have a full committee roster. So I was misunderstanding whether you were a vote to not move the bill or if you are willing to move the bill but maintain your problems with some of the contents of the bill.
I think at this time, Mr. Chairman, to respond to your question, honestly, I think it'd be wise to hold the bill until we have a full committee.
Okay. I will hold then the here at the table the motion to move the bill at this time, and we will take that up again in the very near future. Okay, thank you all very much. Let's set aside Senate Bill 297 at this time and move on to the identity theft issue, House Bill 65. Everybody can get the right folders. Representative Coghill, we see your smiling face out there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So just to recap from the last meeting on this bill, we had the initial presentation two meetings ago, and then in the last meeting we had sort of the nitty-gritty on various sections of the bill and public testimony. We got through all the public testimony at that time on the committee substitute. I'm hopeful that everyone who's interested in the subject now has a copy of the committee substitute and has been able to review that material. We now have the prime sponsor of the bill before us today, And I guess the first order of business would be to call on Representative Coghill to make any comments he would like to make, and then we will start down the list of concerns and requests for information and new language on certain subjects and just work through those. I think there were some written concerns that we've received from some other interest groups that committee staff can present. And we'll just take it that way to try and work through this. We really need to take action on this bill either today or at the next meeting on Tuesday. The bill has a further referral to the Senate Judiciary Committee, where if we don't come to some conclusion about some of the language and drafting, if Mr. Sniffen and others haven't come to a conclusion with Ms. Bannister and others, we may punt that to the Judiciary Committee to keep this rolling. And the bill would need to go on to the Finance Committee, onto Rules, and then onto the floor if that's the will of the body. So with that, that's the game plan for today, but we need to take action today or on Tuesday. We want to do a good job here in this committee, but we need to keep the process rolling. So Representative Coghill, good afternoon, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, I came prepared to give some specific answers, page and line numbers, to some of the questions brought up in the last committee, prepared by my able staff. And
okay. Can I just ask, are those in the order that I'd like to stay in chronological order of in which the concerns were raised, or will we be skipping around if he reads through that material the way you've prepared it? I guess we should do it however you have it written on that paper, even if it's out of order of what we've been doing, just because
there's, Mr. Chairman,
to do otherwise would be confusing.
Probably about, looks like about 9 items here, but they will have some semblance of order to them.
Okay.
We're dealing with 3 of the articles, Articles 1, 2, and 3, so we can keep them in the context. And on my notes here, I'll make sure that we keep that fairly straight. There are some that are, I think, fairly easy amendments, and then okay. There are some that are probably bigger policy calls. So, but I can run down through them.
Okay, and your materials are drafted to the committee substitute, right? So when you're speaking, it's to the current committee substitute before the...
We have a V version, V as right. In Victor, and I think that would reflect some of the changes already that we'll be speaking to here.
Okay. If you could just say what's in the current committee substitute and then what you're suggesting or proposing, that would probably, and just go through the way your staff has it ordered.
Mr. Chairman, at this point, I think the only thing that is in this version that doesn't need to be amended in is a $5 charge that I think Representative Bundy talked about. We had $10 previously, mm-hmm. and through discussion, we believe that $5 is probably a reasonable fee given that many elderly are probably going to be more aware of their ability to do a credit free. So we went through Choice Point and got a listing of those, and $5 came up quite often. So it seems reasonable that it would fall within the area.
Okay, that's the concern, or that's the issue of what other states charge. Senator Bundy's original question, and he can speak for himself, though, was the true cost. Would the fee being charged true. In this bill at $10 or $5 level, because
right.
there are 3 different agencies to consider, would that be, how does that relate to the actual cost of performing the work?
Mr. Chairman, it does not relate to the actual charge. And
okay.
I think that in talking to the various different agencies, they have not quantified them, and I'm looking to my staff to check that out, but I think that is true. So the fee is more of a transactional fee to create a transaction between people. So there's a range throughout the states, none of them reflective of the cost of the freeze.
Okay. Yeah, we're just trying to balance the, you know, the impact on the consumer with the business practice and the cost of the transaction. Senator Bundy, comments on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and did I understand you say that these credit reporting agencies don't have a cost for a credit freeze? They haven't listed one? Or that what their internal costs are?
That is my understanding, Senator.
I suspect they will have one after they get inundated with their $5 one. But
And Mr. Chairman, I think that's probably true because this is such a new area of law throughout the United States. It's probably a very dynamic practice right now. I think California being the earliest one. So at this point, I don't know that even California has quantified that.
So the current, thank you, Senator Bundy. The current committee substitute is $10 per agency.
Five.
Right?
Mr. Chairman, five.
Oh, it's five. It was 10 and it's proposed at five. And I haven't heard much discussion or objection to that. Okay, you want to go on to your next point?
Yes, sir. That was on, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was on page seven. Line six would be the next thing in line under security freeze. This is Article 2. And on page seven, line six, in talking to the credit reporting agencies, they said that on freezing a credit report, they would not do any part of it. It would be all or nothing. And so taking all or part out there, and on page 16, line 18, would be conforming language. In under the definition section of security freeze means, security freeze means releasing a consumer's credit report, not all or part of. So it would be to delete the all or part of on page 7, line 6, and page 16, line 18. Page 16, line 18. And so I would, you know, I didn't draft these as amendments, Mr. Chairman. The information was coming pretty fast at us throughout this day here today. So I didn't know if you expected me to have the amendments drafted up and distributed to the committees, but I think this is one that should be done.
Okay. I've consulted with committee staff. You know, we had the presentation of the committee substitute, and we had public testimony, but I don't believe that we have, we're going to check the record, but I don't believe we adopted the committee substitute.
Okay.
So it's still, you know, an open question before us. Okay. And now you're going through and suggesting further changes to the proposed committee substitute.
Based on the comments that I heard from the committee and in consulting with my staff, unfortunately, I had to miss the last meeting that you had all the questions, but
right.
I think we have them pretty much lined out, but okay. I did not prepare it in a CS.
Okay. We've either got to have amendments, we've got to adopt the committee substitute and then have amendments in writing or easily understood, or we go through and get consensus among the committee and then have a committee substitute drafted for consideration at the Tuesday meeting.
Mr. Chairman,
we need to figure out the easiest way to proceed.
There's a couple ways I could explain what I have in front of me based on the questions you had and then suggest they be put in a CS, and I'm sorry that that we ended up in that
We could adopt them as if there's a if they're easily understood, we could adopt them as conceptual amendments and have them prepared in a CS for review on Tuesday. Senator Bundy, did you have a suggestion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm being looking at nine of these. I'm just wondering if a CS would be a cleaner way to go, because if I look at Mr. Sniffen's language, I don't know if that is something that we could do conceptually. If there's more more to it than meets the eye, I'm not sure.
Okay, well, why don't we just march through your list then, and then we'll make a determination.
Okay, I'll move down through quickly, because some are answers and some are amendments.
Okay.
And so I can go down through them quickly, and if you want to enjoy the rest of your Saturday, we can come back later with a CS and explain them into it. But I think you have a sheet that has all the pieces on it. So,
yeah. Representative Coghill, it's obvious to me that there are going to be enough changes that we can consider those today and have a committee substitute drafted, because we're not going to be able to take action today. It would be Tuesday, and I want everybody to know what we're adopting before we take final action. So,
yes, sir, Mr.
Go right ahead.
Okay, the next one is page 11, line 9, and this is under Article 2, which deals with credit reports and credit score freeze. That was the $5 deal, so we've gone through that. The next one is on page 17, line 20. And this is the one that Ed Sniffen wrote a note on. This will be to amend line 22 and line 24 of page 17 to include communicate or otherwise make available to the general public. This would this would take out the words to request or collect, or request or collection, and this would be what, in order to engage in the business of government, I think the recorder's office thinks that it's very right. important to communicate or make available to the general public that information.
Right, it's mainly DNR, and we had some private sector folks say that this was a big deal for their businesses, and so we want to be careful here.
And we turned the burner up on Ed Sniffen, so if he's listening, I appreciate him.
He is. Mr. Sniffen, I have you signed up here available to answer questions. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Any comments on that point just made by Representative Coghill?
Yes, I do. Real briefly, Mr. Chairman. The reason we wanted to change that language is because in Section 400, the prohibition on line 16, page 16, line 27, is that a person may not intentionally communicate or otherwise make available to the general public a Social Security number. And when we put in the language on page 17, lines 20 through 26, that was a cut and paste from section 410 right below it. And that is a section that related to the request and collection. And unfortunately, the request or collect language carried over into this exception. So this is really a conforming amendment to make that exemption track the prohibition in section 400, so it makes sense. So it was really more of a conforming amendment than it was any intent to broaden the intent of the exemption or anything of that nature.
Okay, and Terry Bannister, the drafter on this legislation, is here, and she's taking notes. Have you two worked together on this point?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't spoke with Ms. Bannister yet. I just got this to Ms. Litzer, aide to Representative Coghill, about an hour and a half ago, but I think it tracks the exemptions in the other sections of this bill fairly consistently, but I'm certainly happy to work with her on that if there needs to be additional okay. refinements to that language.
Okay, good. We're counting on a connection between the drafter and you, Mr. Sniffen, to make sure we work this out. So we're going to proceed through these things and take comments or hear any concerns from committee members as we go along, because I'm inclined to take these suggestions into another proposed committee substitute for Tuesday. So if anybody, you know, has a problem with what Representative Coghill is proposing here in terms of refinement, let's all speak up and make sure we work it out together. But this one sounds like we've come up with better language here. Representative Coghill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the next three items deal with comments that ChoicePoint and LexisNexis made and in consulting with them. Pushing back and forth.
Is this at the top of 18, the expressly authorized or permitted or allowed conflict?
This will be 18, starting on line 12, and this deals with the request and collection section.
Okay, well, let's go back to before you get to that, let's go back to the top of the page, the line 1, if the person is expressly authorized. That's what this CS currently says, but then there's the business folks talking about permitted or allowed, and at the last committee meeting we were talking about, is there some reasonable middle language there that's workable? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. Have you wrestled with that?
Absolutely,
okay.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
Okay.
And the language that we came up with will probably fit lower in the section because I guess I'll give you the broad picture. The broad picture is these folks are regulated under the Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and a couple other federal laws kind of push into that, but those are the two main bodies of law. And what the expressly authorized problem was with them is that under sections 3 and 4, we were getting language that was cross-purposes to
yes.
this. So, but
this was the whole crux of
right.
our concern.
So the question
commerce.
Is, how do I regulate those who are not outside of, I mean, that are not under the regulation of Gramm-Leach-Bliley and Fair Credit Reporting Act, which I want to do, mm-hmm. and still allow them to operate under their federal rules without without violating it. So I think I want to leave expressly in our language up on the top of the page and then put under Section 3 and 4 new language, which you'll see in your comment sheet here, and that would be to insert of the new 3 and 4, and it would say, for an entity regulated by and purpose authorized by the U.S. Code 6801 through 6827, which is a Gramm-Leach-Bliley, and then the next section would be the Fair Credit Reporting Act under page 18, line 16 through 18. And that conforming language then would go down into the next section, 420, and mirror that language. And the reason for that, Mr. Chairman, is they wanted the freedom to be able to have the Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Fair Credit Reporting Act be kind of their main body of law, and then wherever we're more narrow, they would work with us in that area. What happens with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Fair Credit Reporting Act is one has express authorizations and one has permitted uses, and those types of language kind of clash, especially when we're trying to have express authorized language in our statute, which excludes some of the permitted purposes. So this opens it up for them to have those purposes run freely, but for those that are not regulated by them, by the Gramm-Leach-Bliley or Fair Credit Reporting Act, then we have only express authorization. That keeps the hackers or the wannabe thieves from buying and selling Social Security numbers on the Internet or anywhere else in the world who are not regulated by either the Fair Credit Report or the Gramm-Leach-Bliley. So that was kind of the conundrum we were trying to untangle, and I think this language lets them go ahead and operate freely under their federal rules and then helps us to have express authorization for everything outside of that.
Okay. We thought originally we were going to try and find some language with Ed and Terry Bannister between the expressly authorized and permitted or allowed. But you're saying you want to leave that language in the CS, the expressly authorized, and then make the adjustments further on.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the opening to that, if you'll look on the worksheet you have here under what would be a new Section 3, it says, for an entity regulated by and purpose authorized by. And so that includes the two languages that are going to allow them the freedom to operate openly under Gramm-Leach-Bliley and Fair Credit Reporting Act. But I think the terms of art, according to the lawyers, is that it has to be for an entity regulated by and a purpose authorized by. So you have those two in there, and it allows the two laws to kind of dovetail together and work.
Okay. On that point, Senator Bundy?
Yeah. And so this cures, in your opinion, Choice Point's and LexisNexis concerns about the permitted versus authorized.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bundy, I don't know that I could cure the problem, but I think this allows the freedom that they want. And the reason I don't think we can cure the problem is because they'd rather not us regulate this at all.
Okay. This addresses the problem.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. I'm going to, because this is, you know, one of the main rubs here, I want to turn to some folks who want to testify, but I'm going to ask them to testify on anything that's come up so far and this point in particular, and then we'll continue with your list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So we've got John Burton, Jennifer Flynn, and Audrey Robinson. There's the business folks, and then there's Gail Hillebrand from the Consumers Union, if she would like to comment as well. So, Mr. Burton, you were first.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Am I coming through all right?
Loud and clear. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, obviously I don't have the benefit of viewing the language of the proposed amendments, but I think that it responds to some of our concerns, and we certainly appreciate Representative Coghill's willingness to work with us on those two issues, but it does not solve the ongoing problem of the expressly permitted versus permitted and authorized in the other exemption. That said, Representative Kage has certainly indicated his continuing interest in working with us on resolving that issue. We are interested in working on resolving that issue. The problem is we've just got to go back to our lawyers and our industry and try to find language that is going to solve that problem. But to say that these two particular fixes solve all of our problems isn't exactly accurate. It helps, but we still need a resolution of that particular issue, which you referenced, that being the expressly permitted versus some other compromise language in that earlier language. So that concludes my remarks on what we discussed so far.
Okay, so it's the beat goes on with that particular issue. Jennifer Flynn. Thank you, Mr. Burton. Jennifer Flynn.
This is Jennifer Flynn. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Please go ahead. Give your affiliation again, please, for the record.
Absolutely. I'm with the Consumer Data Industry Association. We're the national association that represents the consumer reporting agencies, including LexisNexis and ChoicePoint. I'd like to agree with my colleague, John Burton, about our thanks to Representative Coghill on working on this. I think we've come a long way, and we greatly appreciate his willingness to sit down with us and try to alleviate some of our concerns. We still obviously have a problem, an issue with the expressly authorized language, but I know that we're all willing to sit down and try to figure out a way to make that work. We'll bring down that language to our members and our lawyers and see what they can do with that. And we'll continue to work with Representative Coghill's office to try to come up with something that will actually alleviate the problem.
Okay.
In regards to the other provisions that were mentioned before, I think I want to thank Representative Coghill for the change in the freeze section that does help us greatly thus far, and makes a world of difference in trying to place the freeze.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Flynn. It sounds like we're making progress. I think on the expressly authorized, permitted, or allowed language, that probably won't get resolved with the lawyers and with your members and before I hope we adopt a committee substitute on Tuesday and send this on to the Judiciary Committee. So that may be the place where the final refinement takes place. But I'm glad to hear people are willing to talk and work with each other. Audrey Robinson, did you have a comment? Ms. Robinson?
Yes, can you hear me?
We can. Please go ahead.
This is Audrey Robinson representing Reed Elsevier, the parent company of LexisNexis. I thank the committee for the opportunity to speak to you again and to Representative Coghill for working with us on this language and his staff. The one comment that I would like to make that my colleagues have not made was that, you know, this expressly authorized language and the permitted purpose language really is the rub for us. And while I think that the amendments go somewhat to help us in that regard, I think that we are still concerned that in the FCRA amendment, the language will read regulated by and purpose authorized by FCRA. The entire reason that we had said that we don't want it to say expressly authorized, that we want a permitted uses, is because the FCRA specifically uses permitted use language, permitted purpose language. So unfortunately, I think that expressly authorized being the rub kind of carries over into the new amendments. So, you know, I will certainly run the language by our attorneys and see if this will alleviate our concerns, but I just wanted to state that I think that truly is the rub and may carry over into, you know, causing concern in the FCRA amendment that was adopted into 45, 48, 10, 20, and 30.
Okay, Ms. Robinson, thank you for your time today.
Yeah.
Gail Hillebrand, any quick comments about what we've been working on so far?
Yes, Gail Hillebrand, Consumers Union, Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I think that as you discuss this expressly authorized issue, it needs to be looked in the context of the amendments that are being offered today take away the expressly requirement for the two statutes most closely identified with this industry, Gramm-Leach-Bliley and FCRA. With respect to the whole rest of the body of federal law doesn't, in fact, restrict in any careful or comprehensive way the sale, lease, disclosure, or collection of SSNs. That's why, if it did, you wouldn't be looking at a state bill. You wouldn't need one. Because federal law takes kind of a specific approach rather than looking at the whole problem to say that anything authorized by federal law, even if not expressly authorized, is okay, really is saying that yeah, you're happy with the marketplace the way it is. And if that were true, I think you wouldn't be looking at a bill at all. On the second group of amendments that's been offered today by Representative Coghill, I just want to stress how big of a change in the measure this is, particularly with respect to sale, loan, lease, trade, and rental. We believe the bill will be workable with these changes, but it is a substantial step back from where the measure was when it entered your committee. And there is something useful in these amendments. The federal laws do not attack or address everybody who touches a Social Security number. The federal FCRA regulates certain people. Gramm-Leach-Bowie regulates certain other people. And the way these amendments have been crafted, only those folks who are under the federal law will get some kind of exemption from your law, and that's an important distinction. Thank you, sir.
Ms. Hillebrand, thank you for your time today. Representative Coghill, you want to march forward?
I would like to march forward with one remaining comment, and that is the folks who testified today that want to be out from under expressly authorized, generally speaking, are under the federal law. But it does have some sideboards. But those who are not regulated need to have, in my view, the law pushing at them if they're going to buy, steal, or request collection of Social Security numbers. So I will maintain that I think in doing this, I have lost a few fingers. So I've given my pound of flesh, I think, and so I feel like I've been pushed back enough. Because I actually wanted them to be regulated by state law, but mm-hmm. I didn't want it to be crossways with federal law. So right. I will continue to work with them, and I've told them, just prove it to me. Just prove it to me, and I will continue in that vein, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
On page 3, then, going back to page 3, we'll do with Article 1, when that's breach of security and notification. This would be just an answer to the question on Yahoo. If you look on line 11, if a collector at the end of that sentence there does not have sufficient contact information to provide notice, they can provide notice by electronic mail under A. So Yahoo, and I think it was ChoicePoint, made the comment that there was no electronic notification. Well, Yahoo doesn't even keep addresses online, so they would fall squarely under that exemption and could, in fact, notify by email. So I think I want to keep it narrow, but if they're not in the normal habit of keeping a database of addresses and only have email addresses available to them, then they can notify by email. So okay. I think that answers that question.
So we received a written correspondence from Yahoo on that topic, and so your testimony is that the committee substitute, as is responsive to that concern?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Okay.
So then on page 9, line 4, we'll deal with the insurance question regarding security freeze. And on lines 4 through 14, the insurer... this, I think, gives insurance companies more than enough ways to deal with a consumer that has come to them for insurance issues. And I'm trying to think of what the question was. Maybe I should. It was, I think, during access during a security freeze was the question. And this is an exemption. I can't think what they wanted, Mr. Chairman, was not to be in the exemption category, but to be given permission up front rather than an exemption in this section. And I think this allows them to look over to a certain degree during a credit freeze, but only for these reasons. And so I think we narrowly crafted it on purpose. And quite frankly, I don't think they like that. But I think that's kind of the new world that we're in. If people are going to protect their credit, to me it's a policy call that it should be rather in the exemptions rather than in the permissives.
Okay.
So
I'm not going to call on everybody, but Ms. Flynn, are you still there? Do you have a comment on that last point by Representative Coghill?
In regards to specifically the insurance exemption?
Yes, ma'am.
Our membership, the credit reporting agencies, would recognize that I believe 33, and I'm not sure about that, it might be 32, but I believe 33 states do have an insurance exemption for the credit freeze, but that is something for the state to make as Representative Coghill has said, a policy decision on. I do believe at this point, though, the majority of states do have an exemption under the freeze laws that currently exist.
Okay. Thank you for that information. Representative Coghill?
So I think that answered that question. That, in my view, does not need an amendment. The next one was the concern report regard to printing the Social Security number on a student transcript. And so if on page 20, line 2, I think we have an answer to that question that does not need an amendment. The sub 5 on that portion on disclosures, it says the prohibition does not apply if the disclosures for a background check on an individual, debt collection, identity verification. And I can't think of any other reason you'd have it on a transcript other than for identity verification. And I think that is well suited if they need to use that for identity verification. If they want to use it for anything other than identity verification, I would be suspect. And so I think that they are well within their right to use it for transcript transmittal, and especially if it's for identification, because you might have 15 John Coghills. You might have to identify him by that identifier.
That one seems pretty clear.
So, and then the other one is on page 15, line 18, and this is under Article 2, reports of credit freezes. Suggestion was under sub 10 there, instead of a consumer reporting agency, we would delete that and put a person if the database or file. And this is a word fix that just needed to be fixed. If you look under here, the subsection here talks about exemptions, and they're all talking about a person. So the operative language here is sub A, the provisions of this section do not apply if the credit report, use of a credit report by a person, if the database, and it would be a consumer reporting agency. But
okay, so that's a suggestion, but that needs to be incorporated.
I guess the point that was made to me, Mr. Chairman, was credit reporting agency will not use a credit report. They will dispense a credit report. So this is a person if the database or file consists entirely of information used for these other reasons. So they would have it, but not, I think that was the question. I'm looking at my staff to nod. It's just a word fix.
Okay. Ms. Bannister, are you?
I will get a final. I'm just making a note.
Okay.
I will depend on what is finally given to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but we've made note of that issue. So, sure.
And Mr. Chairman, that is all I had, and it was the questions that I understood that this committee had, and really the compromise that I was making with those who are in the industry, which I'm very sympathetic to, truly am. But I'm also trying to push a policy call.
I know you're a conservative, pro business, Republican, experienced legislator. So
I find myself in this situation as being a consumer advocate in the policy call world, but I still want the businesses to be able to operate freely and cleanly until they make until they do a breach or have some need to notify people. And Mr. Chairman, I'll reiterate, the reason I think it's so important is that once somebody has their identity taken from them, they have to go about proving themselves to be innocent. Mm-hmm. And they actually are responsible for the cost of a failure of somebody else. And even going before a court of law are not probably going to be able to easily get their name back, their credit back, or sometimes their entire life back. So to me, it's that important.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate your work on the issue and some of the compromises that have been made. So, Ms. Bannister, could you come back to the table for just a second? I'm just going to ask you if there is anything else besides what you've heard today that are going to be submitted to you in writing for drafting of a new committee substitute to be considered on this coming Tuesday at our meeting. Is there anything else you need, any clarifications from the committee or from staff that would help you with your work?
No. Once I get the suggested language, then I will develop and clarify things at that point. That usually works for me.
Okay. Very good. Mr. Ed Sniffen, are you still there? Is there anything that... any last comments that you'd like to make?
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Other than I appreciate all the work by the sponsors, and I'm available at any time to assist in any way I can.
Okay. Mr. Owen, could you come back to the table for a minute, please? The issue of the Yahoo correspondence with our committee came up, and it appears that that's been handled. Is there any other correspondence from any other affected party with a concern that we have not, that has not come up yet?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman. I believe all of the concerns have been addressed in one fashion or another.
Okay. Not everybody's satisfied, but everybody's having a voice here in this process. Okay.
That would be correct, yes.
And if anything else comes in before Tuesday, make sure you bring it to our attention. Okay. Is there anyone, were there any of the folks online or anyone here in the room that would like to say something before we, you know, go about drafting a new committee substitute and final consideration on Tuesday? Any other thoughts that need to go on the record? If not, that's all we have before us today. I appreciate folks hanging out with us to get a lot of work done here on a Saturday afternoon. We appreciate that very much. And if there's no further business to come before the committee, at 5:15 in the afternoon, we are adjourned. Hope you all have a good weekend.